started. We have an unusual situation where our John Quinn, our chair, was called away for an emergency meeting at work, so he will not be in attendance today. And our vice chair, Kim Keenan, is also not in attendance. So that leaves us to our next option, which is we can elect a temporary chair for the day and move forward. Because Randy, it looks like we have a quorum.
We do, definitely.
We have a quorum, so we are in good shape to move forward. So the process would be someone would need to make a motion about a chair for the day. We've already talked to Larry Schoen. He said he would be willing to chair for the day with my assistance. So if someone would want to make a motion about Larry being the chair for the day, we can move forward.
Only because I see all I have to do is welcome introductions and approval of meeting minutes and the rest of staff.
So moved.
Second. Got a first and second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. First successful action of the day.
Oh, no,
so hopefully not our last. And you're welcome to come up to the front.
So let's say taking the lead from John, what John would usually do, even though he'd be better looking than me and younger. We'll start with first of all, welcoming everybody to the meeting of the Maryland Department of the Environment Air Quality Control Advisory Council. If you're here for the meeting on default of student loans, I'm told that's in the photos and across the way. We do have, thanks to staff and somehow to some budgetary ability of the department, we do have refreshments in the back, hot coffee, and some pastries that are low carb, I understand.
That's it.
So let's go around the room and do introductions first at the table and then in the background. And while we're doing that, I will remind people, if you are visitors and you intend to speak, at some point we do have a point in the agenda where we have space for that. So please make sure that you sign up the speaking list, which is somewhere going around.
It's circulating.
Okay. And it would also be helpful, that list will eventually make its way up here. It would be helpful if you said which particular subject you wanted to speak about. So I will start and go around the table.
Great.
Larry Schoen, Schoen Engineering, Columbia, Maryland, representing the American Society of Mechanical Engineers.
I'm Tad Aber, and I'm the Air Director with MDE.
I'm John Coombe with EA Engineering, representing the American Institute of Chemical Engineers.
I'm Ross Solowitz, University of Maryland. We study air quality academically. I'm here to represent that.
Hussein Bahi, Regulation Development.
Hi, I'm Jed Miller, Health Advisor here at MDE.
Josh Oshodende, Regulation Development, MDE.
Larry Casey Camp, representing Maryland State and DC, AFL-CIO.
Julian Levy, I'm subbing for Lauren Gerritsen, representing Children's Environmental Health and Protection Advisory Council.
I'm Jonathan Case. I'm new on the board here. Representing farming, I'd like to maybe suggest a more appropriate title of agriculture, natural resources, and I'm with the University of Maryland Extension.
Kevin Barnabas, I'm the Environmental Health Director for the Harford County Health Department, representing MACO.
I'm Cindy Parker from Johns Hopkins.
University of Maryland School of Medicine.
We may have council members on the phone, Randy. I don't know if we can.
Please check if the line is open.
Yeah, we've opened the phone line. Are there any council members on the phone?
Okay, not hearing any. Let's start with our visitors. Could we start with you right over there and go right around the table?
Jim Dunne, Chesapeake Automotive Business Association, representing the aftermarket industry in the state of Maryland.
Roscoe Bresney with the Manufacturers of Emission Controls Association.
Dave Kramer with NRG.
Gene Trisco with American Coalition Clean Coal Electricity.
Jermaine Dahe, Tepco Holdings.
Karen Iron, MDE Air Quality Control. Marshall Wade, MDE Mobile
Mobile Sources.
Carl Munder, MDE Mobile Sources.
Josh Berman, Sierra Club.
Paul Eisner with Raven Tower.
And much for the Exelon Tower Board.
Amber Dudovnik, Environmental Resources Management.
Mike Danielson, Trinity Consultants.
Paul Fiore, Auto Care Association.
Okay. Next thing is approval. First of all, let's take a look at the agenda. Does anybody have any suggestions for the agenda or any objections to the agenda as printed? So, you have a short update yet?
So I usually start off with a little short update on a couple of things that have happened since we've last met. A couple of them are pretty critical. Over the past several months, EPA has moved forward with something called a clean data determination for the ozone standard in the Baltimore area, and that was actually finalized last week. It's really good news because it shows how much progress we're making. First time in my 30-year career that the Baltimore area has been recording attainment levels of ozone, which is great. But as some of you followed our communications on that, I don't think we can declare victory yet. A lot of that that progress, a lot of it had to do with the control programs that you all had worked so hard to implement, but it was a very cool, unusual summer in both the summers of 2012 and the summers of 2013. So it's great progress. It's a great indicator that things are moving in the right direction. But between the fact it was a cool summer, an unusual summer, and the fact that EPA is under quarter of a deadline to finalize a new standard, a tougher standard, this October, we still have a lot more work to do. So great news. First time in 30 years, Baltimore's not been non-payment for ozone, but not a real, real can't declare victory quite yet. So the other major a piece that's been going on is that the NOx regulation that the council approved at its last meeting is the 2015 requirements are moved forward. We have a briefing on this, so I won't spend a lot of time. But we are going to be holding a process on the 2020 requirements to see if there's not a different way to get the same public health protection, environmental benefits, but to do it in a way that is more sensitive to not losing jobs. So we have a briefing on that later, so we don't need to spend time on that. Those are probably the two big, I guess the other news that's pending is that EPA is soon to release its Clean Power Plan. And again, we may want to do a briefing for the council at the next meeting about the Clean Power Plan. A federal initiative to require greenhouse gas emission reductions from existing power plants. Maryland has been and continues to be part of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, 11-state partnership on reducing greenhouse gas emissions from existing power plants. So that's going to be you see a lot about that in the news over the next couple months, so that might be a good briefing for us to bring to ACAC the next time we meet. So that's my update, Larry.
Okay. Any questions for Tad? Okay, hearing none, let's move to the first action item on our agenda, which is COMAR 26-11-02-11, permits for obtaining, procedures for obtaining permits for certain sources. And just to remind folks, the role of the council is advisory to the department.
Did we approve the minutes?
We'd like to do the minutes.
The minutes. Thank you. Was that a motion?
I'm not sure I can make a motion. Okay. I'm an observer.
Why don't we take a moment to look at the minutes, which were distributed by email. And also...
Yeah, everybody should have it in their package. Randy, this was also emailed out earlier, right?
Yes. Yes, Russ.
I just want to commend whoever put the minutes together for very assiduously marking where in the audio recording comments occur. This is fantastic. So thank you.
I agree. So yeah, I agree with that. It's very nice. Joshua and Carolyn. And that is something that's posted online as well as the actual audio recordings of our minutes on the ACAP webpage. And
thanks for that observation. All right. Any comments or suggestions on changes to the minutes from the March 30th meeting? Is there a motion to approve the minutes as written and presented? Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor? Any opposed? Any abstaining? No opposed, no abstentions. Okay. Ben, thank you for keeping me in track as chair. Ben, the first action item.
Well, I know you're a newbie, so.
There you go. You got to help me out. So I only had two things to do, and I already...
Well, you're 50%. You got it going.
You got to remember, your metric is better than John. So far, you're okay. All right, so procedures for obtaining permits, and again, to remind, our role is advisory to the department. The department, I guess, puts rules out for the benefit of the, and for review by the public. They often listen to our recommendations. In fact, I've never... seen them not listen to our recommendations.
We always listen.
But that is our role. So we'll turn it over to Karen.
Hi, good morning. My name is Karen Irons. I'm manager of the Air Quality Permits Program here at ND. We're going to be talking about, there's really three regulatory changes that we're proposing to make. All three regulatory changes, they're all being done to make our regulations for air permitting requirements to be consistent with statutory changes that have already been made. There was one change made in January 1st, 2010, and two October 1st, 2013. So we're actually already implementing these requirements because the statute supersedes the reg. But my goal today is to move these regs along so that we have regulations that are consistent with the statute. And I'll talk about each of the three statutory changes that were made and what we're changing to the regulations. Well, first of all, they all affect air permitting, and specifically they affect air quality permits to construct. These are pre-construction permits that are subject to Section 2404 of the environmental article. These are permits that are subject to what we say in permits, expanded public participation. So it's just not all our permits, but they're the big permits. What's a permit to construct? You've probably heard people talk here before about operating permits, Title 5E. But permits to construct are the permits that air emission sources have to get before they build something or before they modify an existing facility that has air emissions. There are some de minimis exemptions, but we have a pretty comprehensive air permitting program in Maryland. Permit to construct can apply to an individual piece of equipment or process line, so any one facility can have a lot of permits to construct, hence why we have also have an operating permit program. Not all permits to construct are subject to expanded public participation. And the first bill that I'm going to talk about, called the Standing Bill Law, it didn't change who was subject to public participation, it changed the process. This was Senate Bill 1065. It was effective back on January 1st, 2010. It actually doesn't just affect air permits, but these regs are just air permitting regs. What it did a couple things. One, it expanded standing for who could challenge an air quality permit to construct. And then the second thing it did, two big things, was it substituted direct judicial review for the previous contested case hearing process. And there were other procedural changes, and the regs make those changes. Just to go over our public participation process for permits to construct, it's still a multi-step process. Informational meeting, public hearing, and then the last is really a simplified thing, judicial review, which will be the contested hearing. Informational meeting, there was no change to the informational meeting requirements. It's the first step in the process when we have a permit subject to public participation. It's just an idea where the permits program goes, or NDE goes out and explains the permitting process, and then the company explains what they're doing to citizens. It's not always how, it's only, you know, only for projects that have a lot of public interest. It can be very contentious. We had hundreds of people at some of our informational meetings, crematory, a compressor station, so it just depends. Again, no changes to that. The next step is a public hearing. If we decide to make a tentative determination to issue the permit, we have to provide an opportunity for a public hearing. If we have one, the court reporter prepares a transcript. A new requirement that's in the statute and that's in the regulations, that the comment period can now be extended once for an additional 60 days if someone requests it. We do get that request a lot. Tentative determination. The statute contains a lot of requirements that have to be in the tentative determination because of the judicial review process, and that's been put in the regs. One thing that didn't change is the same way as now as before. If we don't get any adverse comment, the tentative determination becomes a final determination and the permit's issued. That's the way it was before, it's the way it is now. Final determination. If we get adverse comments, we prepare our response to comments, document, and a notice of final determination. That happens a lot. The second part is if we tend to make a final determination that's substantially different than the tentative determination, we really haven't done that. We made changes to the tentative determination in response to comments. Usually the public make good comments about we should have more monitoring or things like that. We might make that change. However, if we do make a substantive change, then we would go out for another public comment period just on the changes that we made. Judicial review, this is a big change besides the standing part. Contested case hearing in the past, and it's been years since I've had to do a contested case hearing, the permit would be, until the contested case hearing process went through with the Office of Administrative Hearings, so it could take months or even years to get through the contested case hearing process. The judicial review process is, if someone wants to object to a permit, they have to go to court. Again, we expanded standing when you could challenge a permit. A petition for judicial review must be filed within 30 days after the publication of the notice of final determination. Since we've been doing this, we've gotten two petitions for judicial review. One was withdrawn by the petitioners, and the other one, after years, is still pending in the courts. It's still going on. That's probably the biggest bill. The second bill, this was a permit streamlining bill. House Bill 95, it was effective 10-1-13, it was a department bill. And the idea was to provide a streamlined process for really small sources that were having to go through this 6 to 12 month process. It's an alternate public participation process, and it's for sources that triggered public participation solely because they were subject to EPA's new source performance standards. Back when the statute was written, new source performance standards tended to be people like iron, steel mills, and pulp and paper mills, really big sources. But over the years, the 30 years, EPA has drafted new source performance standards for really small emergency generators, little engines, really small sources. So people were getting into the public participation process, even though they were really small. And we never had any public interest yet. We had to go through these resources that could be better spent maybe dealing with more environmentally important project. So, and the main reason that people, we have a list of state pumps to operate sources, and those are sources, big sources, they're sources that people, you know, crematories and asphalt plants and aggregate industries and pulp and paper, they're still subject to public participation. Some of the examples of people that are now subject to this alternate public participation process are small combined heat and power facilities, medium-sized boilers, landfill gas energy. And a lot of these sources were located at government facilities, military bases, hospitals, universities. So they now go through a process where we do have a public comment period. We publish notices on NDE's website. We send letters to elected officials. So we notify people and we provide the opportunity for the public to comment. And so far, since we've been implementing this, we haven't got comments on any of these. We never did before and we don't now. I mean, we could and we would address them, but we haven't because they tend not to be the kind of sources that people care about getting a boiler 1 mile radius. This was put in by the people who were concerned about not getting notification. It was actually a Public Service Commission permit, but anyway, what it does is that we have to notify people. We try to notify, if you can get on interested party list, it's very easy if people want to be notified of their permits. We try to make it easy. I have a public participation for me who maintains interested parties list. But anyway, we actually use a GIS program. We draw a circle around the property when we get an application, and we send letters to public officials of all jurisdictions located within 1 mile of the property line of the source. A lot of times that's not much, but if you're down in like Prince George's County, you can pull in 4 or 5 small towns. So anyway, that's the last one, and that's just that's also a requirement. We've also been doing this since we're going into the back. So that's it. People have any questions?
Karen, just to clarify, so on the first one, it sounds like the regulated community is already following the statute.
We're implementing all three of these. The problem that I have is our regs don't reflect what we do, and I think in the interest of transparency, our regs should have some relation to how the actual permit at all of this.
But in the trenches, people are already following the statute.
Yes, we are doing that. We're doing all three of them since the date those bills were effective. We've been implementing them. Again, the standing bill does affect more than air. The last two are just air permitting. They just affect us.
Just a question on the extended comment period.
Yes.
That you have an option for. If anyone just asks for one, is it automatic?
Yes.
Okay.
If anyone asks for a hearing, we grant it. Anyone asks for information, we don't really set barriers for people doing that.
Okay. Any other questions? We'll give people a few minutes to take a look at the actual reg. While they're doing that, I think I saw perhaps another visitor or two come in. Are there people who came in since we did introduction? Would you mind introducing yourself?
Yes, Jeff Rogers.
Say it again.
Reagan Powell.
Anybody else? Yes.
I'm David Smedic with the Sierra Club.
And did either of you plan on addressing the council for one of the subjects?
Not today.
No. Okay.
And the sign-up sheet is somewhere circulated.
It's on the front table.
Mm-hmm. And for those who did recently come in, there is coffee and low carbon emissions snacks.
Can I ask a question? Can you give me an indication of are emergency generators, stationary emergency generators, subject to pilot food permits?
Emergency generators over emergency only generators over 500 kilowatt and 500 brake horsepower limit that you do. So even if any people might yes, are subject to air quality permits to construct.
Okay.
As well.
Thank you.
Waiting for any questions from the council. Need a couple more minutes, or do you want another minute or two? Or all right.
Yep.
Anybody have a motion to recommend to the department the approval of these changes to the regulations? Okay. Thank you, John. Is there a second, Sonia? Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor? Any opposed? Any abstentions? No opposed or abstentions. Okay. Second item on the agenda then. Aftermarket Catalyst and Carl Munder will be doing this presentation. And just to just a little bit on our process, the process that we usually use is the department presents the proposed change to the regulation, and then we take discussion and questions from the council members, and then we often go before a motion, we go to the visitors. We do have two people who have signed up to speak on this particular issue. And then if the council believes that it's at a point to take some action, then we entertain a motion, and then we have some discussion on the council, and then action. So having said that, let's pass the baton to Carl.
I'll just give a little context. The permit was procedural, it was sort of streamlined, catching up. This one has some substance. This is a fairly significant NOx-reducing initiative. It's one that we've worked on with the other states and the Ozone Transport Commission. We've worked with the private sector on this as well. We've also worked with EPA. It's an important one, but all of our rules, there's always a nuance or two. So we're gonna try to walk you through some of the things that were evolving as late as the end of last week. So, but this one is a fairly important one. Regionally, it gives us significant NOx reductions along the I-95 corridor. So it moves up our priority list. So.
Thanks, Dad.
Just to put the pressure on.
Exactly. It is a nice point to start off the week here. Well, I'm going to start off basically first explain what a catalytic converter is for anyone that might not know. A converter is a device that's installed on the vehicle that reduces emissions formed during combustion of fuel in a gasoline-powered motor. The converters contain a combination of precious metals that reduce the amount of pollution that is being emitted from the vehicle. And as the converter age, there's a potential for contaminants to build up on the precious metal surfaces that reduce the efficiency of the converter, and that's why the reg is being developed here. If a converter goes bad on a vehicle, there's currently three options for replacement. You can get the OEM converter, which is basically the converter sold by the vehicle manufacturer. There's a second option of putting a used one on there, which is where you might get the same thing as a bad converter. And the third one, which we're discussing today, is the one manufactured by a third party, also known as the aftermarket converter. As I said earlier, there's two types of aftermarket converters, or two certification levels for aftermarket catalytic converters. There's a federal one, which is pretty much currently sold in Maryland, and then there is the California Air Resource Board, or CARB certified converter. I'm going to do a quick review of what a federal aftermarket converter is. It is performance based on reduction efficiency of 70%, 70%, 30% for the pollutants of hydrocarbons, carbon monoxide, and NOx. The manufacturers themselves test the converter and then send the results to the EPA for certification or verification and to a performance warranty of 25,000 miles. The CARB program is a little bit different than the federal. The converter, if there's a CARB converter available for the vehicle, the converter must allow the vehicle to meet its original certification level. So if the vehicle came from the factory as a ULEV or LEV or TLEV, that converter must allow that vehicle to meet the certification level. It also must be compatible with the OBD system of the vehicle, which has been pretty much on all vehicles since 1996, all light-duty gasoline-powered vehicles since 1996. And it does not allow the installation of used converters. And the CARB, the California Air Resource Board, reviews the test results from independent labs of certified converters. This is different than the federal program, which is dependent on the manufacturers to send them the test results. Once the converter has been, or the test results have been reviewed, and they meet CARB standards, executive order is issued for a specific engine family, like 2.3 liter V6 or 4-cylinder. They work on certain engine size families. CARB audits and tests the converters to ensure that they meet their standards, and there's also a warranty of 50,000 versus and 5 years, which covers the converter parts and labor versus the federal program of just 25,000 miles for performance. There's a need for an updated program because the federal program with the federal converter has not been updated since 1986. It's not considered significant technology advances since 1986 to now. The Ozone Transport Commission has said that OTC has made a push for an updated program from the federal program to
developed a model rule based on the CARB aftermarket converter program. Currently, there are two states that have instituted or adopted the OTC rule or some version of it for an aftermarket converter program. That's New York, which is currently doing it, and Maine, which will be in instituting the program within the next several years. And other OTC states are planning on moving forward. But this rule will move Maryland forward, but it will also continue to push for a federal program. We don't want to be like the lending state. We want to hopefully get a federal program out there or implementation through a partnership. This rule just makes sense as more of a regional federal rule, more so than thing. Hopefully the federal program will pick up soon. The benefits of the new converter technology is tailored converter technology progressed dramatically in response to stricter vehicle emission standards. The new catalytic converters can reduce engine out emission by over 99%. The federal aftermarket catalytic converter program has not benefited from the new technology progression. And allowing poorly performing federal aftermarket converters on new vehicles defeats the technology advancements that of today's vehicles. This is just a summary chart of saying why is the CARB's improved converter better than what is the federal. Say the converter efficiency is better, the 7730 for the federal. The CARB must meet the vehicle certification level. The warranties, conversion efficiency for the federal is 25, CARB is 50,000, so you get double the warranty. And it is required to make it to be compatible with the vehicle control system, the OBD system. The federal is not, the California version is. Also, this would allow consumer protection through a better warranty is another important reason to move ahead. As Tad mentioned earlier, this is more of a regional thing. As this chart shows, aftermarket converters has a potential for a large reduction in NOx on a regional area. Somewhere about 30 tons per day of NOx reductions in the OTC transport state would be realized. Greater reductions if a national program, and compared to other options, this is a large NOx reduction. The industry, we have talked with industry. The industry is generally supportive of this measure. OTC has worked for over 3 years with manufacturers, and the OTC has industry support for the efforts on the model rule and is assisting us with pushing the EPA for an updated federal rule. One concern of the manufacturers is that it's much better to do this if it was a federal rule and a piecemeal adoption. Now I'm going to summarize the regulations based on the OTC model rules. Requires California approved converters on model year 2000 and newer, beginning in 2018. It prohibits the sale and installation of used or recycled converters. Provides waivers for unusual cases on a case-by-case basis, for say if there's an exotic vehicle out there, Ferrari, Lamborghini, or something that does not have a California converter on there, contact us, we'll verify that, and then we'll issue a waiver that they can put a federal converter on their vehicle. This regulation applies to a person that installs, sells, supplies, or offers for sale in the state an aftermarket converter that does not meet. And this rule would sunset if the EPA revises the federal policy or if EPA and OTC develop an alternative implementation program with the manufacturers. Maryland's progress is so far, we're anticipating adoption by the end of 2015. We held a stakeholder meeting in April 2015 and listed. It was attended by the Chesapeake Automotive Business Association, Washington Maryland Dealer Service Station and Automotive Repair Association, MECO and Manufacturers of Emission Control Association, and Auto Care Association. But again, since they were generally supportive of the overall goal, but would prefer a federal program or a partnership process. Any questions?
So again, we'll take questions from the council members first. Yes.
I'm going to, just out of curiosity, because I haven't replaced an old converter in a while. What happens to the old converters?
Normally, whoever takes off recycling sends to the salvage yards. They should.
They get paid for the old ones, or they get some?
I presume. Once they're recycled to South Care, they'll get some money for it, depending on the market rate for the platinum, palladium, or whatever precious metals are in there.
Okay. And you said there's a 30-ton per day reduction, and that's over all of the OTC states?
OTC, yes.
Okay.
That just about doubles if EPA does it as a federal requirement. Did we hand out the letters on OTC?
They were sent out to the council.
Is it just a little history? This is something OTC has been working on for a long time, and at least twice we have formally asked EPA to move forward with this as a federal requirement. It's actually something that should have been done a long time ago. I think the last time it was updated was the 80s. So we've asked, we've been told twice no. So at a meeting last week, it was a Transport Commission meeting last week, we actually asked the question a slightly different way. We've been working with the manufacturers, and there is the beginnings of some kind of a partnership effort that would allow for the aftermarket catalyst to move in, but to be done in a more market-based, perhaps non-regulatory way. And so that's why one of the problems with having these ACAC meetings on Monday morning, May 15, is if you find links, you say, some of us were working over the weekend. The whole partnership thing was just added to this presentation over the weekend, because EPA actually was very interested in working with the states and the manufacturers over some kind of an alternative program. So the way we've tried to structure our rule is if we get this through a federal rule, or if we get this through some other alternative process, then that would in essence trump our regulatory requirements. So just think about trying to enforce this rule where you have the internet, you have Pennsylvania right next door. You know, this is truly a rule that really should be done as a broad regional rule or as a federal rule. So anyway, that's one of the nuances.
John.
The partnership was decided on the weekend, so I'm not that familiar with it. So that did an excellent.
I assume because we're talking about retrofit of existing vehicles, that there's no connection in statute with our obligations to the California Clean Car Program. Is that right?
No, this is not really directly linked to California Clean Cars, but it is building off of some work, a lot of the work on the aftermarket catalyst comes out of work in California. In essence, the OTC model program is built off of the California aftermarket catalyst program.
And you said that the two states that adopted the model rule, the OTC model rule?
New York and Maine.
Right. How close do you feel with the other states and the OTC are to adopting the rule?
Yeah, Connecticut and New Jersey are both a little behind us, and Delaware is a little behind them. And then the other states are even a little bit further behind that. But part of why Maryland wants to move forward is to create some momentum to get some other states to move forward. And in all honesty, if you get a more than just a handful of states, that creates pressure for EPA to turn this into a federal rule.
And have those states adopted it identically to the CARB rule?
As far as I know. Yeah. There might be some little bit of changes to more of the part of the states, but for the most part, yes.
So the concern about going next door, being economically driven to neighboring states that haven't adopted it yet, how long do you expect that might persist as an economic driver?
But you notice the implementation date is 2018, so we're giving it some time to see if the federal rule doesn't. But that disincentive would last. I'm sure you're going to hear that from manufacturers. That disincentive would last as long as you had the inconsistency between the two state rules, which is a problem.
In terms of our concerns about upwind contributors to our ozone versus OTC states maybe following as a model rule, how important is a national rule to us in that respect?
It's a great question. There is a dialogue going on between about 30 states, and a lot of that discussion is focused on power plants. But more recently, there's been a lot of interesting analysis that shows that in the 2018 to 2020 timeframe, the contribution in areas like Atlanta, Georgia, and Sheboygan, Wisconsin, Holland, Michigan, is going to, at that point, be very much dominated by mobile sources and less dominated, less contributed to by power plants. So yes, this is a live item. I think people are thinking about it. Now remember, a lot of the country isn't struggling as much as we are with the current ozone standard, but I think everybody knows there's a new ozone standard coming. And so I think there is some momentum to make that, you know, and it could be that over the next 3 or 4 months, there might be some other states who have not traditionally been working with us in a partnership like this. Some of the upwind coal states may join us in pushing EPA to turn this into it, because this would provide NOx reductions in all those states that have I&M programs as well. So that is building, but it's not quite there yet.
I just had one question about one of the details here that it's your presentation said you require the use of these new converters on model year 2000. And is that, why model year 2000?
It's just an early implementation of OBD. There was some issue between some manufacturers, so we just picked 2000. It's a 4-year kind of that, and also the most of the vehicle fleet by 2018 would be like
Is that realistic in terms of CARB aftermarket catalytic converters being available?
We believe so. Yes, because the CARB pretty much like 6 model years newer. Most vehicles, I want to say, like, are under warranty for 8 years or 80,000 miles. So that takes care of the first 8 model years, and as hopefully by 2018 they will have a better manufacturer make of converters.
And does California require it from model year 2000? Like, is it modeled after California?
I think they've had their CARB permit for a while.
I don't think they make the distinction.
Yeah.
Okay. So my question along this is just to be sure that we're not in sort of a situation where you have all these exemptions from some model year 2000, yeah. 2001. Well, they really exist.
As far as my wife's car is 1998 Honda Accord. I went online this car is for that, or that our cars are certified. So I'm sure for the, I want to say the more popular models, you know, that the convertibles are out there. Okay. So they should be available.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yes.
Yeah. In the presentation, I noticed, you know, all the comments were positive, but there's obviously a lot of, you know, economic impacts and other things on this that I guess will be brought out by folks here. But, you know, there definitely is a large, you know, increase in cost. Now, I mean, to speak, my daughter's had a catalytic converter, you know, replaced. And again, living in Washington County, there's no doubt that she would have gone across the border.
Yeah.
And the shape of Maryland, the way it is, that would seem to be quite pervasive when you're talking about that amount of money.
Do you recall?
Pardon me?
Do you recall the amount it cost?
For the standard one she got, I think it was $250 or something like that. But it would have been, I don't know how much more it would have been for another one. That was just for the converter itself.
Yeah.
But again, you know, if this is something that really benefits the urban area, but again, a lot of people that live in rural areas that do drive a lot more miles and in many cases have, you know, lower, you know, net incomes and so on and so forth, you know, I just wonder if it's going to unduly impact people more in rural areas.
Hard to say. I mean, we would hope that they would do the right thing and stay within the state and do it. But unfortunately, it's hard to say how much converter prices depends on who's installed it, where they get it, and the number of converters on a vehicle. So, I mean, as you thought I said, the $250 converter there could be just for one. The vehicle could be 3 to 4, depending on the vehicle make a model. I would hope it would not adversely affect the more rural areas of the state, but that's always a potential.
I also think the other important factor is that the higher end converters have a much better warranty. And so there is a consumer protection aspect to this that's
just slightly less important than the air quality benefits, but it is a, there are some consumer protection aspects of what we're doing as well. New York really pushed that very hard. But they were the first to move out to do this, and they actually pushed that as perhaps an equal driver to air quality benefits is the consumer protection.
Thanks for that question.
I have two questions. One is, I noticed that there'll be a need for a new enforcer, a new position for enforcement. And I'm just curious, how will enforcement be accomplished? And then my second question has to do with CARB, but how will enforcement be?
We anticipate enforcement would be like the standard, the way the state does it as a standard consumer product, like the gas cans and stuff. We'll do spot checks and automotive stores and online and stuff to make sure that they only can have the CARB converters in stock or for sale.
Okay, and there will be no enforcement over the internet or?
The best I could say is like something like that. It's like hopefully, like if you did something on, say, Amazon Now and you wanted to look at the converter, would say it's not for sale in California. You know, say, I'm trying to do that, sorry. You threw me off there. Let me get my brain pumping a little bit.
another problem with Monday morning meetings.
If you look at it, it's like if you do like a federal converter on Amazon for a specific make and model, says this converter is not for sale in Maryland, blah, 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 the states that have that. We would hope that they would do the same thing for Maryland and they would spot check themselves. So it's kind of like the gas cans do. We would presume that a store would only be importing the proper products, and we would hope that the internet resellers would, you know, cover themselves by saying, hey, it's not available to ship. I've never tried ordering a federal converter from it and say we can't ship it or not, so I can't say.
Okay.
Julie, your question's a great one.
Oh, yeah.
The council has seen over the past few years that as we've looked for more and more areas to find reductions in, that we're getting into these non-traditional areas, which carry with it some of the difficulties. I mean, one of my standard jokes is I joke about how in the old days it used to be my big, tough enforcement folks would climb stacks and put go up the top of the stack and, you know, now they stroll through the Walmart perfume aisle and check out the VOC content. So it is a lot of our regulations of the past 5 years have carried with it these difficult enforcement challenges. And Carl's right, we cannot enforce every store that sells these. We do spot checks, and what we've seen is that over time, it usually takes some time, but over time, it generally does work out really well.
Is there any chance of spot checking when you do the emissions testing to see?
There would be. We've talked about that. So
okay.
How would that play out? So if somebody puts a federal one on, would they fail? Could they fail the emissions test for that vehicle? Or would they still pass?
They would fail.
I mean, basically, if you put one on, the check-in light needs to stay out. It is case proven that if you put a federal one, the check engine light comes right back on.
Okay, so what does that consumer do at this point? Do they get a waiver because they are following the law?
They would have to go through the normal bill process. They would have to spend
more. And my guess is during the early years of this, we've been very flexible with waivers for those situations.
My other question has to do with CARB. If CARB changes its requirements, its specifications for a catalytic converter, then the people in California have an opportunity to participate in that new regulation development, so they can be heard. But then we automatically adopt the CARB regulation, and the citizens of Maryland don't necessarily have that same opportunity for public participation, or do they?
That's correct. We're adopting an actual. We're not really adopting per. Are you saying like we're adopting, what's it called, by reference, the CARB standard? We're not really adopting, we're just adopting this. I mean, it's like manufacturers would follow what
But CARB specifies what the catalytic converter is supposed to do and what performance standard it's supposed to meet. So if it increases that standard...
Would it be a moving target? In other words,
right.
If CARB changes their rules, does it automatically... Or do we need another rule change to follow
the
updated
CARB? I don't believe we would need another rule change. It would be basically manufacturers would have to follow the CARB standard. So it would not be another rule change on our part. It would just have to be a CARB-approved converter installed on it. We would hope that California would not backtrack. They would stay, you know, standard.
And Julian's concern is that they raise the bar.
Yeah. That's right. They raise the bar. And
the public doesn't have a chance to...
Our public doesn't have a chance to participate, whereas the California public would have a chance.
Every once in a while, maybe once, twice a year, Kim Shepherd will come in and walk you through a series of regulatory changes we need to make in our regulation because the California LEV program has made changes. And so I would assume it would hit that. It works the same way. It's not one I've looked at myself. But we, in Maryland, we do bring those kind of changes in the California program back through our public process.
Okay, so the public here would have a chance. Okay.
And including the regulatory change. And so we rarely have gotten negative public comment, but we, you know, I think Tim Shepherd was here last meeting, 2 meetings ago. So anyway.
But the key is the public here would have a chance to participate. All right.
Yes.
You want to go first?
Go back.
Yeah, I guess there is a real impact, I guess, this will come up about the impact on small business.
Yeah.
And, you know, Maryland is seen pervasively as, you know, not really sensitive to small business in terms of its impact and regulations. And this kind of adds to that, I think, certain industries for sure. And I work with a lot of folks in agriculture in urban areas. That's fairly pervasive, you know. And I just wonder, in this case, this is about ozone, and especially in the non-attainment areas. And I just wonder about if that's the case, that maybe this is should only be something that's required in those non-attainment areas and not required of folks in more rural areas where that's not an issue.
Is that something you considered or thought about?
Not really. We would hope that it would be a statewide regulation, because then it's the same thing as it comes to potential for enforcement, too. We would like it statewide, because this is a regional effort, too, so it would be a statewide effort more so than a regional effort. I mean, it was taken into consideration. I'm not downplaying your concerns. I can totally understand the industries.
Well, it's done in other areas for air quality,
You
know, and non-attainment for permits and other things, so, I mean, it would seem... And it does have, you know, there is a significant economic impact in certain areas. I realize the difficulty of that, but I put it forth as a fact that as an option.
I think we got this concern that lower incomes out there.
It's not the ozone attainment.
I mean, we're looking at this regulation as one of the consumer product types. I mean, I believe most of the consumer products are statewide.
Yes.
So the regulations are statewide. So that's what we were trying to look at and go for.
Thank you for that. Yeah.
I mean, we'll, if it comes to it, we can entertain it and potentially look at it, but we would prefer it to be a statewide regulation.
John.
Thanks, I have two questions. One, following on what you said, the VEIP program has a window on compliance here. Did I understand you say, Carl, that in the event that someone fails a test, well, first of all, I think you said if someone puts a federal converter on where under this program a CARB converter would have been required, their check engine or their warning lights are not going to stay off. Is that right? So
depends on the vehicle. Most of the time it would stay off. It would come back on, and they would fail. They would have to probably go through the normal fail process because the best thing I can say is hopefully if they put a federal converter on, we'll look at that But yet, basically, when they put a converter on, they're supposed to receive paperwork, the vehicle, and then they're supposed to receive some paperwork from the installer saying what type of converter this and that is. And we would hope by that time, I mean, maybe in the transition years that would happen, but hopefully within a year or two of the stop coming to Maryland, that would not happen.
So, is your question, would they fail under the current regulation, or would they fail under the future regulation if they put the federal on?
Under the future regulation. I'm understanding that, you know, when you go to the station, you're going to have a certain set of parameters, the vehicle, make, model, and year, and a performance level for at least some of the vehicles dictated by that standard that couldn't be met with a federal converter. Is that right?
Not sure. I think I'm trying to say like certification standard.
Did you have some or some?
I'm having a little confusion with this particular.
Hold on one second. Sure. Did you have some just on that question?
Just for clarification. Rosto Bresny with the Manufacturers of Emission Control Association. Federal converters are also made to be compatible with the OBD system. So unless it's a defective federal converter, the mill light will stay off, will be off. Now, how long it stays off, you know, there's a greater deterioration with a federal converter than a California converter, but you know there's also ways to keep the light off without actually delivering emission reductions, and that is by putting other components into the converter rather than precious metals, so it will fool the light to stay off. All right, and that's why California in their program made sure that the California converters were compliant with the OBD system, not just compatible. You know, so you actually get emission reductions if the light is off. So there's a safety check there. But if you put a federal converter on, a federal converter is designed also to keep the light off and until it degrades.
For how long? And that's the thing. It's like this program there for emission reduction regulation.
But for a certain fraction of the extant fleet, the California converter is going to provide greater reductions than the federal converter. Is that right? Well, maybe go back to a few slides. You showed performance levels being different.
The certification, I mean, 7730 is greater efficiency. As I said, must be the certification level of a vehicle. That's a little bit different. I mean, basically, the federal converter is one level, one standard, 7730,
right,
across no matter what certification level the vehicle is. You're aware that the different vehicles have T-Lev, U-Lev, and C-Lev.
Right.
There's a different certification level from the factory, which is much tighter than the 7730.
Right. Yeah. So for that fraction,
the car converters will give us better benefits in the long run versus the federal. As the gentleman said with the method, federal converter could deteriorate quicker than the car converter. So therefore, then three weeks after putting one on, potentially the check engine light would go back on and you would violate and would not receive the benefits that we would under the car program.
If I'm understanding correctly, under looking at the VIP as a window on compliance here, you've got two issues. The gentleman said, depending on how it's installed, the federal converter inappropriately installed under this new regulation might fool the indicator light system. The CARB converters are intended to be fully compatible with the OBD system, so there's none of that. But also, for some fraction of the fleet, the CARB converter is going to get a greater reduction, right? So the mismatch between the actual, does the OBD system indicate the mismatch between the what you're referring to as the original certification level performance and what the vehicle is doing?
Does the OBD system identify the converter? Not in generally, no. It depends on the OBD system. Compares the efficiency of the front of two and the rear of two. So as long as it's within a certain range, it will. I mean, as the gentleman said, the federal converter can keep it in that range for a while. Mm-hmm. Might be a shorter period than the car, but the vehicle itself does not identify the converter. There's not a chip in the converter that communicates with the car saying, hey, this is a car versus a federal. It's not that advanced.
So that difference in tailpipe performance level isn't apparent in the VIP process.
We don't really, are you saying like the tailpipe emission? 996 knew it did not receive the tailpipe test in
anymore. So there's no way to know whether the vehicle that should be meeting an original certification level is. Is that correct?
Not unless that check engine light is. We go by the check engine light in the VIP process. We depend on, you know, that the software is working by the beep. As long as that beep engine light, as long as the check engine light is off, the car is determined, the computer system of the vehicle is determined that it's meeting the certification level. So if it's just like a federal verdict could work fine for a shorter period, but we're looking for the long range benefits of the emission reductions.
I'm sorry, I'm still struggling just a little bit. Okay, so you have a car, 2001 vehicle.
Okay.
All right, that car is designed with the federal converter.
What do you mean,
designed
with?
Well,
I it's sold.
It was sold with the federal converter.
No, it's sold with the converter that would keep it with the certification level. Oh. Federal OEM, let's take the OEM converter is separate of the federal converter process. The federal converter process is just for aftermarket converters.
Okay.
So
basically the cars that are already manufactured out there meet that CARB converter.
It would meet the standard, whatever the vehicle is set, so it would probably meet the CARB.
So it's only if you're replacing that.
Yes.
Gotcha.
I mean, that's why I said you have an option if you really want to, you can go back to the, say, Honda or Chevy and buy their converter, and that's totally independent of the CARB and the federal program.
Okay.
So does the federal one typically have a higher standard than what came from the manufacturer?
No, it's lower standard.
Lower standard.
Lower standard.
Other members of the council?
Sorry, one more.
What
does the department estimate is the typical percentage of the existing fleet that would be subject to the need to replace the catalytic converters in a year within this time frame?
I know we've had the numbers recently. Not off the top of my head, John, I don't know.
It's a couple percent. It's a couple percent.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Nobody has to apologize for asking questions to me. Okay, so let's start with Julian.
Just
we'll
a
go
quick,
down the line.
It's a three ton per day reduction is expected from this. And just for perspective, what's the total tonnage emissions in the Baltimore area? Do you know?
Several hundred tons.
Okay. Less than 1,000?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Jonathan. I just had a question about when you put if you were put this new CARB converter on an older car that didn't have it originally, is there a problem with, you know, the performance or with additional carburation or ejection things that have to be changed as a result to make it adapt? Because I talked to a mechanic about this and he indicated that perhaps there were. I'm just asking the question.
Off the top of my head, I mean, we would hope again reduce it back to certification level. It's like back like. Now, it comes as like the 2000 vehicle, that's another reason why we might have picked the 2000 off the top of my head, is that at that time it's like more dual certification, the federal standards and the California standards were kind of coming into coalescing together. So we would hope that most of the undercarriage parts are, you know, the parts that would have to be added to the exhaust system potentially would already be that is. From the manufacturer, this stuff, the items that are called direct fit. Basically, if it's designed properly, you just unbolt the old one.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about
the
mechanical aspects. I'm talking about, for example, oxygen sensors and other parts of the emission program.
Back pressures.
Should not be.
Well, I just wondered if. I just heard that maybe there was.
O2 sensors. I mean, they should not be.
You're asking if there's a difference between the federal,
in other words,
currently allowed and the proposed one.
In other words, if a person if this were adopted and they put a CARB on one that had a, you know, existing,
would
there be additional costs because there have to be additional
mechanics done.
The manufacturer's coming tomorrow.
if
you have some information for us.
Yeah, there's really, these converters would completely fit on one for one on the vehicle. No, I mean, there could be other things upstream that are not working properly, in which case they have to be repaired. For example, if there's an oxygen sensor that has failed that made it look like the catalyst had a problem, then that may require replacement. But these are all parts that are on the vehicle already, so no additional parts would need to be put on the vehicle. But it's important to make sure that the engine is operating properly, the oxygen sensors are operating properly, because if you don't check that out, you could put a new converter on, whether it's an OE converter or a federal converter or a CARB converter, and it's not going to work properly.
And are you aware of any issues with back pressure or other?
No.
Not aware of that.
That's all.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions from the council? Well, true to form, I have a question or two. So the OEM would no longer be permitted?
No, OEM
still would be permitted. Okay.
Yes.
Is the OEM then a lower, is the OEM supplier being allowed to meet a lower bar than a CARB?
No.
Yeah,
it was just separate. It's
product.
Just to get a comparable product.
So the OEM is still going to have a 50,000-mile warranty?
If that is dependent on the OEM.
It may not. So there might be a lower bar there.
Well, warranty maybe, but it also is, it depends on whatever Chevy, let's say GM might have offered the 25,000 from there as just.
But that might be a lower bar than,
yeah,
than the
for a warranty,
car
yes.
one. What about emissions reduction? Is the bar the same?
It would probably be the same or greater as the OEM. OEM would be the same or greater. Should not be a lesser bar than a California.
Okay. And the other question I had was, I assume in addition to individuals who have to pay the bill, or I assume one of the industries affected would be the auto salvage industry. Were they represented by one of the associations?
I'm not sure if the members make up the salvage. How would you say that? I don't believe there's many used converters that are taken out of the yard. Out of a salvage or anything like that. Well, I'm saying it might happen, might not happen, but normally the cost of the precious metals, the salvage yards receive more money from the precious metal recycling than they would probably from the part.
And my last question is on the OBD, onboard diagnostics, that are part of the converter. Does the converter itself actually measure anything?
It's the O2 sensors. Normally, a vehicle will have 1, 2, 3, 4 O2 sensors depending on the converter. It would have an O2 sensor in front of the converter and an O2 sensor in the back of the converter. What the OBD system does is they compare the signals from the O2 sensors. If they see something out of whack, then they check engine light.
That's all it does? It doesn't measure hydrocarbons, carbon monoxide?
I'm not saying it has not met that, but most vehicles just go by the standard O2 sensor, some form of option.
Okay. Any other questions from the council? Yes.
What's the difference in cost between a federal and a CARB? For the consumer?
We are being told by the agency it's just several hundred dollars between the cost. I'm not sure. I haven't come down to the numbers if that is cost for the supplier, manufacturing cost, or direct cost. You know, obviously, a retail shop can charge what they want. But we're being told it's only about several hundred dollars or more between a converter. That's not saying if your vehicle's got four converters on it and all four of them need to be replaced, it's not going to be $1,000 more. It's just like $200 more per converter.
Ross?
Carl,
yeah.
Bottom of page 10 of the material we were given,
yes.
I'm just going to read it. It says it is estimated that a car aftermarket catalytic converter costs $300 to $500 more than a federal aftermarket CC, depending on vehicle, make, and model. I just want to get that out there because you said several hundred, then you said 200, but it's 300 to 500 is what we're giving you.
Yeah,
so.
I'm just throwing a number. I'm several hundred to 200. I sometimes get to a couple hundred to several.
So we should rely on what's in
there. Yes. $300 to $500 more. But again, I said, depends on how many converters are on the car. Got a single one, it's $300 to $500. It also depends on the vehicle.
$300 to $500 more than what? What's the cost of one?
Federal standard.
Yeah, what's the cost of one?
What do you mean?
What's the total cost of the CARB?
Is it $300 to $500 more than $500? $300 to $500 more?
Oh, $300 to $500 more than what the standard, what the cost.
But he's asking, do we know what the total number is?
What's one cost now?
Federal cost, see, depends on the make and model of the vehicle. There's not one cost per converter. It's make and model specific. Understanding the.
Did one of the other gentlemen say $200 if your water was $200?
Just the part itself going to Advance Auto and buy it was $250 for a 2002 Camry, which I understand that they cost more for later models. So if you add 500, I mean, just add the higher level.
Yeah.
You're talking about $750 repair just for the part, and then, you know, a couple hundred dollars, whatever, to put it in.
Later,
so all of a sudden, you're talking about a lot of money.
Yeah. But it all depends on the make model. It's kind of when you get cost depends. It's hard to make money. You said it's $250. Cal 11 converter for your daughter's car might have been $200. Right? It's kind of like hard to gauge without knowing what you.
Yeah, I understand.
What the first number is.
Now this applies just to residential. To vehicles, right? This does not apply to trucks and truck fleets and
Gasoline as of. Currently,
now
the gasoline-powered vehicles.
Gasoline. Other questions from the council? All right, we have two folks then from the industry. Rasso, you were one. You've helped us out with some information items, but if you can try to keep this to we only have a few people who want to speak, but we are getting close to the time that we allotted for our agenda. It's okay to go over, and we often do. But if you can keep it to 2 or 3 minutes, I'd appreciate it.
Right. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm Ross Stoberesny with the Manufacturers of Emission Controls Association. And I certainly am very impressed with the level of engagement that the council has had on this issue, and a lot of excellent questions, which, maybe I can address some of them, and if you have others, I'll be happy to take those as well. MECA represents emission control manufacturers for the whole range of internal combustion engines, everything from weed whackers to ocean-going vessels. And we've been doing this since 1976, since catalysts were first put on vehicles. And we represent a majority of the aftermarket converter manufacturers as well. And we've been engaged with California when they adopted their program, through their regulatory process, as well as the federal program, and so forth. So, we continue to meet with California annually in order to talk about implementation issues and things like that they're seeing out in the field. And we were engaged in the New York DEC process a couple of years ago as they went through their regulation. And I guess, we understand the air quality issues that are here in Maryland as well as a lot of the Northeast states, and the fact that you need to do something. And I think we commend the Department of the Environment for recognizing that the in-use fleet is one area where you can get emission reductions. MECA did a test program several years ago where we side-by-side compared a CARB converter and a federal converter. And we observed that a CARB converter gets you on the order of 85% lower NOx emissions after 25,000 miles of use, and over 60% lower hydrocarbon emissions. So it's really a significantly better technology, and we've been working with the OTC, and we've been working with EPA to try to get them to upgrade their program to the levels of emission technology that there is today. And the feedback we've gotten from EPA is always that we don't have the resources to do this. And I think that one of the things that we've been working with is looking at a more creative way to approach this, and working with Auto Care Association to get someone at EPA to work with us on kind of a voluntary program through there. EPA has this voluntary mobile source emission reduction program, which allows states to get SIP credits for for these types of maybe industry-run programs or things that we're gonna have those discussions and work through that and hope that Maryland can join that conversation as well. You know, I guess to address some of the questions, the things that we've observed between California and the New York program is the problem is really with enforcement. Whenever you have one state that has tighter regulations and requires more expensive technology and the neighboring states don't, you have a lot of this out-of-state, people going out-of-state to get their converters fixed. California has the same issue. However, California has dedicated a lot of resources in order to address that. And the two main things that they do as part of their emissions inspection is not only do they check the OBD light to make sure that it's off, they also look at the converter and make sure that it's the right converter on that vehicle. And I think the provisions in the Maryland regulation that make sure that the label is visible, I think, prepares for that. But it's important to actually have that process as part of the emissions inspection, because what California, if you don't have the right converter on there, the emissions fails and the vehicle has to go out and put the right converter on. So that's really the only way you can enforce from this out-of-state, purchases of the cheapest technology. The other thing that, I think the best way to do this, and short of doing that kind of a rigorous inspection, the best way to do this is through a federal program. And that's something that we hope we can get some progress on, because the federal program would do two things. It would eliminate this issue of enforcement, because now you only have one technology out there that's available for people to use. And it also broadens the level of coverage that you have on vehicles, because there are some vehicles that the CARB program doesn't have technology for, and these are the federally certified vehicles. When an OEM sells, I guess before 2000, now most OEMs are using 50 state certifications, so it's just one certification. But some of the older vehicles can either have a federal certification or a California certification. So the California aftermarket program only approves aftermarket catalysts for the CARB certified OEM vehicles. So there's a certain percentage of the population that don't have CARB converters, and those would either have to get a federal converter, or there are some CARB converters that may work on those vehicles, but it's a little bit more of an uncertainty.
Rasmus, as far as how you make sure covered. You tell us if you're in favor of the regulation as it's currently?
Well, I mean, I think, we were in favor of the California regulation. We supported that program, but I think the issue with other states is that if you have these enforcement provisions covered, then you can get the reductions that you're trying to achieve without the proper level of enforcement and the actual visual inspection on that converter and failing the vehicle if it's not the right converter, then it's you're not going to get the emission reductions. So that's, I understand that's probably not within the Department of Environment. That's probably in a well, it's in your emission I&M program, right? And I don't know how that's handled. Right. So anyway, just to kind of close, I want to, thank you for this, for moving ahead with at least looking at ways to get better technology in the state and get emission reductions. And we want to work with the department as well as EPA to try to get a federal program in place that's at the same level of performance and durability as the California program. Thank you.
Good. Thanks. Council have any questions for Rasco? Yes.
One question. Given your comment about EPA's longstanding intransigence about addressing it nationally, I think everyone would agree that that's the best solution, but it doesn't sound like that's promising. So what alternative do states like Maryland have?
Right, and that's the issue that states are faced with, is if and in those cases, I mean, we're hoping that we will get some progress through this kind of industry state EPA coalition to get some of this to get a program in place that's this voluntary industry run program. But in the absence of that, I think having these inspection provisions and enforcement provisions are essential if you want to get real emission reductions.
All right. Other questions from the council? Yes, John.
So I guess under that frame, when you look at enforcement at an emission station, that would also allow the option for actually having that regulation in certain areas of the state and not others.
Well, if that's your only means of enforcement is at the inspection station, then that would be limited to those areas. But it depends how the department would decide to enforce that.
Okay. One of my jobs is to move us along. We're getting a little behind.
I guess by having
agenda,
a federal program,
federal is the best way to go.
Yeah, other questions from the council for Rastow? All right. The other, Jim Donahue, you have signed up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The aftermarket is every place you take your vehicle.
Just remind us what group you represent.
I'm sorry, Chesapeake Automotive Business Association. So we represent the aftermarket in the state of Maryland. So we represent the parts distributors, car repair shops, independent tire dealers. Okay. So the aftermarket is every place that you take your vehicle after you're done with the car dealer, and that's what the aftermarket is. Okay. Our members have no objection to cleaner air. Okay. And second of all, and this might surprise you, we have no objection to the CARB standards for catalytic converters. Our problem is with the implementation of it and the logistics of doing so, because most of our distributors cover the multi-state area, and so now they're going to have to put an inventory, which you just heard is substantially more expensive, and they have two inventories, one for Maryland, one for the surrounding four states and the District of Columbia. So at our original meeting with Carl and his staff, that we expressed that objection that it's going to be very, very difficult and very expensive to do that. The second one, I think, is at the level of the repair shops. One thing about a converter is it really doesn't go bad by itself. It's an inert object, okay? It's a brick with these expensive materials impregnated, okay? And they burn off. Unless something happens, they last well over 100,000 miles. So why do they go bad? Well, they go bad because something in front of it in the engine system has gone bad, and that's what's affecting it, all right? So the 50,000-mile warranty on California, on CARB, is really feel good because it's really never going to happen. The problem is going to be when something happens in front of it, a mass airflow sensor, something else goes wrong, and it ruins the converter. Now the consumer is faced with, instead of $275, they're going to be faced with $500, $600. And they're going to get angry at the repair shop, okay? And they didn't do anything. They took care of their car, but something just standard went wrong. The converter's now bad. So you're going to have a lot of angry people, I think, as this is implemented by itself. And our problem is, it's Maryland being an isolated state, surrounded by other states, not having the CARB standards. And that's where we see people are going to go across the state line. Doesn't matter to you when you're not concerned about business, you're concerned about clean air. The controller of the state of Maryland is probably going to have a problem with it as he loses tax revenue going out. But that's our objection, is that we think this is going to be very difficult to implement in an isolated state. So recognizing that you are an advisory board, our association is urging you to advise the Maryland Department of Environment to wait until everybody gets it, or to ask them to flex Maryland's power in the Senate and the House of Representatives to get this for a national bill. Thank you. Okay,
thank you, Jim. I'm going to ask for questions from the council, but before I do that, I'm just going to say that my sense is that there are a lot of questions and concerns, and Ted saying there isn't urgency to take action today. So if this winds up being an information and Q&A and stimulates thought for the September meeting, that's okay. So now questions for Mr. Donovan.
So I didn't understand at all the opening of your speech where you said that there's stuff up in front of the catalytic converter that gets it to go bad. That I understood, but then you said people are going to be mad at the repair shop because if it's warranted for 50,000 miles, to me, my understanding of that means that they have to replace it at no cost to the consumer. That's what a warranty means. So could you elaborate on why you said people are going to be mad at the repair shop?
Well, somebody's going to have to replace that catalytic converter, okay, at up to 50,000 miles. All right. Yeah. Now, if that shop put it in, the converter really wasn't bad under the scenario I'm suggesting. Converter really didn't go bad by itself. It went bad because something else caused it to go bad. All right. So is the repair shop, who maybe let's say installed that converter 25,000 miles ago, is he responsible for that converter going bad because something in front of it in the engine went bad?
Okay. get, I still don't understand, if the warrant, if the manufacturer of the converter warrants it for 50,000 miles and it demonstrably has failed, doesn't the manufacturer have to replace it? It's not, I mean, if, okay, if I, I'm really trying to, I'm not
yeah,
trying to be
I
a
got
jerk,
you.
I'm
okay.
trying to understand this. If I go replace my catalytic converter and it has a 50,000 mile warranty, I don't have to go back to the same repair shop that put it on, right? I have a warranty now. I'm probably not going to be able to find it after the first 1,000 miles, to be honest. But assuming I can find it, the warranty, can I go to any old repair shop and doesn't whoever manufactured?
You'd have to go back to where you had the work done.
I think the problem is that the warranty is the company is going to warrant it against manufacturer's defects, not against an upstream failure that causes the...
And they're going to say it's not bad.
Conditional warranty.
Okay, so maybe, and maybe it's not bad. Okay. Okay, but again, I don't understand this notion of being upset at the repair shop. I mean...
All right, let's say it was your car, all right, and your car's 10,000 miles, and something goes bad in the engine system that makes your converter go bad, all right? It just, oil gets in there, that's what... be one of the primary causes, and it caused it. Nothing to do with the converter itself. The converter itself was still good had the oil not gotten on there and spoiled it. So you go back to the shop and you say, hey, I've got a warranty, I want a converter replacement. He sends it back to his, ultimately the manufacturer, and the manufacturer says there was nothing wrong with this converter, okay? But it's defective and it can't work in your car. So who's gonna pay for it? And that's what I'm saying.
Your point is the 50,000 versus the existing 25,000 would make that situation worse.
It just feels good. That if you're telling
the situation still exists.
Yeah, exactly.
Doesn't the situation exist right now that could happen within 25,000?
Correct.
So this just makes it a little
worse. So I'm just saying that the 50,000 mile warranty is really irrelevant to converters. But it will cause aggravation.
Got it. Other questions from the council? Yes.
Yes.
You raised the concern about suppliers' inventories increasing and their costs increasing. Sorry, back to my question from before about the number of vehicles that would require a replacement in a given year. I did a quick check online. Is that about 3 million autos registered in the state? About
that,
right?
That sounds about right.
So you're saying a couple percent of that would need...
A couple percent of the failures. And I can get that number for you. I'll have that number for you.
I'm just trying to sort of add up the dollars and cents of that effect.
But John, you have to carry them all.
Sorry?
The distributor has to carry them all.
Understood. But in terms of the number and the quantitative increase in their inventory costs, do you have an estimate of that?
My guess is there'd be 200 to 300 part numbers, I'm guessing conservatively, at $200 a piece. Per distributor location anyway, if not the individual parts stores.
Well, given that there seems to be consensus that the EPA is not going to move anytime soon, what would you suggest that the states...
I wish I had an alternative for you to suggest.
Well, the issue...
If I did, they'd be paying me the big bucks, you know?
The issue that the other gentleman raised about really tight enforcement provisions, do you see that as a way to protect the suppliers of aftermarket equipment?
I see the it's going to be hard to determine whether that's on a vehicle or not. I don't see it when you go through the 2-year emissions inspection. I don't see them going under there and seeing whether yours is a CARB or a federal catalytic converter on there. It's just not going to happen. So that's what you're talking about.
You wouldn't agree that enforcement procedures are...
It's going to be very hard to enforce it. I think it's going to be very hard to enforce it. You know?
I just want to get a roadmap. Does anybody on the council want to make the case that we must take action on this today? Okay, so I'm going to assume that we're doing informational questions. We're a little bit over the time we allotted. So if there are questions that are pressing right now, please ask them.
I do have another question. So if I did have a failed catalytic converter and I wanted to replace it, not with OEM, but with a CARB certified, could I do that? Are they available in shops here?
The answer would be no right now.
Okay, so I think that's very sad. So I have two choices, the weak federal one or the very expensive OEM, I assume that the CARB, if they were available, would be priced in the middle somewhere. I mean, I know that, you know, when you have a 10-year-old or 12-year-old car, going to the manufacturer for anything is big bucks. So I think it's sad that we don't at least have a choice.
Well, they could get it for you. If you want it, they could order it, special order it. That's okay. Not a problem.
Okay.
Yes.
I would like to hear what you have to say about the warranty issue. Is the warranty a real warranty, or is it more likely to fail because of a non-manufacturer issue?
Well, it is true that it's a conditional warranty, so it warrants the converter against manufacturer defects and so forth. So if there's something upstream, like poor air fuel ratio control or something like that on the engine that caused that converter to degrade faster, then the manufacturer would not cover that. But that's going to be true for the OEM, it's going to be true
right.
for the federal, it's going to be true for the California. And in fact, just an earlier question on the OEM warranty, an OEM warranty is 1 year, 12,000 miles, okay, for a replacement converter. So, and the cost is two or three times above a California converter. So
right.
you do have these three different levels of options, of both warranty options, cost options, and performance options.
So, council members, if we're going to take this up in September, make sure we want to make sure we give requests to the department about what other information you think you'd like to have in front of you if we are to possibly take action in September.
Larry,
yes.
Jonathan.
I'm not signed up to speak, but we're working with Auto Care Association. I just want to kind of clarify and reiterate at least one point. The manufacturers really are enthusiastic about the level of response we're getting from the EPA at this point. To use I really regret using a football analogy. However, we've never got out of the end zone. I think we're at the 25-yard line at this point, and there is some momentum. So I don't want everyone to be discouraged about the level of cooperation we're getting with the EPA on moving this. The biggest issue that the manufacturers have with the CARB program is not the standards. It is the executive order process, which is cumbersome, expensive, and not very efficient. And this is part of the problem that the manufacturers have had, and I'm sorry, the wholesalers and distributors have had. So the possibility of the federal program would eliminate that issue, because we would have a CARB standard converter without the executive order process. And each engine family number has to be approved. So that's where all of this is coming from. I hope I haven't.
Could you say what you mean by the executive order process?
That is the certification of the part number to become a CARB certified catalytic converter.
It's an administrative process.
Yes.
That CARB has.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a process that has to be done for each one?
For each part number.
Testing or something?
For each engine family number. And in New York State, this was part of the issue. When New York State adopted and implemented this rule, there was only coverage for about 50% of the vehicles in operation in New York State. So, we have some struggles.
Buy certain cars.
All right. We're about 20 minutes over our time for this.
Interesting. Yes. I'm not sure why.
We only had one, but there were several years worth of OTC stakeholders in the process. We'll probably have another before we bring it back to the Senate.
All right, so what I've heard from listening to the discussion is people had a lot of questions about of what people are doing right now, how much are they paying for an OEM installed on the car, and multiply by how many there are for each car so people can wrap their minds around the cost. And some comparison between the OEM cost, the federal cost, and what it will be with the CARB. What impact are we making on people's pocketbooks? That's one line of questioning I heard. What else would the council like to know? Yes.
Given the issue of how slow EPA's been, and despite the gentleman's assurances that we're on the 25-yard line, that's still a ways to go.
How long?
So, given the pending new ozone standard, and as Tad said, we can't declare victory yet, even though we've had a couple of good years, and the potential reduction associated with this in the state and regionally, it doesn't seem to me we can afford to wait for the EPA to act.
So what would you like from the department?
The issue of how to enforce the regulation, how to minimize the bleed over into adjoining states where the economic incentives might prompt people to go.
Got it.
I'd like to understand more
information about how they will enforce it and how we'll handle this bleed over issue. Yes.
And just as an addendum to what John said, and to pick up on what our culture representative, what Jonathan said, is it, I'd like to see the next time it's brought up, is it feasible to implement a rule that is not statewide but is countywide? Is that feasible? And, you know, the way you could do it is by having the label of the catalytic converter exposed at the inspection station, and if we were to exempt a handful of counties and, you know, mandate the rest, then, you know, c'est la vie, perhaps we have our cake and eat it too, in that, you know, where the folks who heavily travel the beltways, the I-95 corridor, we see that from space. We see the NO2 signal from space. You know, they have to adhere to it, and those who probably don't, on average, go there, you know, they have the same standard as the adjoining state. That should at least be discussed mm-hmm. next time.
Got it.
Actually, just an issue, I don't think Garrett and Allegheny County even have beep stations, emission stations. So that's a whole other issue if you were to have an enforcement mechanism.
Other items from the council that you'd like the department to give us more information about next time?
Can we submit questions after
sure,
the meeting?
Absolutely. Okay. Sure. Yes. Sure. If you need time to think about
it. Within the cost, I'd like to know the cost per unit, but also what is the statewide estimated total cost, taking into account that it's only 1-2% of the replacements and, you know, number of replacements and that kind of stuff. I don't know if y'all can, if y'all
so
have that information.
So not just the cost per, but some broad market information, how many people are doing this, what's the overall impact?
I guess I'm aware that there's more than one catalytic converter on a car in many cases. There's a couple of them. So I guess the question is, if one goes bad, do they all have to be replaced, or can you just replace that one? I was never quite clear about that.
So that we could use some more clarification.
Because that would escalate the cost considerably if you had to replace them all in line.
Use more clarification about that. Thanks. Thanks, John.
So the other piece that will be available next time we come back is there is going to be a meeting in July with EPA to build off of the 25-yard line analogy. I've expanded a little bit. I'd say we're starting the fourth quarter, and so far in the game, we've not gained 1 yard. The fourth quarter starts, and the first two plays, we've all of a sudden made 25 yards. And so, don't get me wrong, there's a ways to go, but the fact that EPA said something other than no was a fairly important step. And so I am encouraged that EPA is going to work with this. And these problems you've identified are the problems we've known were coming with this rule the whole time we've been talking about it. And actually, it's quite a difficult rule for states to adopt. And so so we appreciate all the good input. We are at a point in the process in Maryland where the things we're trying to reduce emissions from are no longer terribly easy. You know, peak day power plant emissions. Emissions from vehicles where the consumer is involved because of the cost of the effort. So anyway, we'll work through this, but we do owe you some better information.
Okay, so again, thank you for the level of engagement. Really is impressive, as usual, on this council. And in that note, we're going to some briefings at this time for possible future action, for future information of the council.
Yes.
So we'll start with Tad presenting on control of NOx emissions from coal-fired generating units.
So this is a very brief update. We spent a tremendous amount of time on this reg at our last two council meetings. But there have been some things evolving over the past few months, and I wanted to bring the council up to speed on where we are. Just quickly cover sort of where we went in 2014, a quick look at the rule that's now been fully adopted and is effective, a brief discussion of some work we're doing to take a look at alternatives for the 2020 requirement, and then next steps in schedule. And this is a very brief briefing. A little bit of background. October 6th, the council did approve a comprehensive NOx regulation for coal-fired electric generating units. It, in essence, had two basic steps. Requirements for 2015, provide immediate public health protection, immediate NOx reductions, and then a 2020 step, which was designed to even get deeper NOx reductions and additional public health protection. We have moved forward with the 2015 piece of the reg. It's now in place, and we are starting to look at the 2020 step to see if there aren't additional options for us to consider. And I'll go through each of those in just a little bit. So we did move forward with the 2015 requirements, virtually identical to the requirements that you all approved through the last ACAC meeting. We did submit the 2015 requirements as an emergency regulation to the Administrative, Executive, and Legislative Review Committee. AELR did take action and approve that emergency action to become effective on May 1, 2015. And so that regulation is now on the books, and we are working with sources on implementing those provisions of the rule. Again, the 2015 requirements were in essence designed to make sure that every unit was minimizing emissions by optimizing the existing technology on that unit, and it set up a fairly comprehensive process for how a company needs to show that each day of the summer they are optimizing the technology to minimize NOx emissions. Generally, this gives us an additional 10 tons of NOx reductions and about a half a ppb ozone benefits just from the 2015 step. The 2020 requirement, this was deeper reductions in the 2020 time frame. The council had very lengthy discussions on the options for the 2020 step. In essence, there were at one point four options on the table, an option to add selective catalytic reduction technology by 2020, an option to convert to natural gas by 2020, an option to retire the unit by 2020, and there was a fourth option that didn't make it into the reg, and that option was an option that would be something that was a little bit more flexible, but that would get equal or greater public health protection. And I think the council saw people's thoughts on that and weren't convinced that there was such an option on the table, so the rule was finalized and moved forward with just the three. We are now going to take a longer look at whether there isn't a fourth option that can provide equal or greater public health protection, but do it in a way that protects Maryland jobs and helps more with Maryland's economy. We do expect to have a formal proposal on this by late summer or early fall of 2015, and we expect the 2020 requirements to be fully adopted by the end of the year, and we will be having a stakeholder process to go through the 2020 update. Just a recap of our schedule. Again, the phase one, the 2015 requirements are now fully enforceable in effect through the emergency action. Stakeholder discussions during the summer of 2015, late summer discussion at ACAC, early fall proposal in the Maryland Register, late 2015 fully adopted. And that's really all I had in my briefing. Very quick, very specific. We will be having additional discussions. We will be bringing this back to ACAC. But that is where we are. We just wanted to bring the committee up to speed because this was a significant issue that the council had gone through for the previous two meetings.
Just quickly.
Behind,
oh, I'm sorry.
Behind.
All right. As a member of this committee, are we automatically notified of the stakeholder meetings?
Okay. And what level of reduction are you looking at for 2020 statewide?
Well, the previous rule required three options: add an SCR, add natural gas, or the unit had the option of retiring.
Yeah.
So there's not one single number. We're going to be looking at all those options and making sure that if there is a fourth option that's put on the table, that it provides equal or greater emission reductions and equal or greater public. There's not a specific emission reduction target.
Okay. Well, I guess maybe let me rephrase it then. Is there an overall statewide reduction that you're looking to achieve by this?
It's going to ensure that there's more equal or greater public health protection.
Gotcha.
Jim?
Larry, I should know your name. So, Larry, was your question, do the council members get a specific email notification about a stakeholder meeting?
Yes.
Not normally. We can do that. We will definitely for this one do that.
Okay.
Other questions from the council? All right. Thank you, Ted. Hearing none, we'll
short for once.
We'll let you go on to your next one. Was there a question?
Two people signed up to.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Just to remind you.
Thank you. So we do have two members of the public who have signed up to speak. Josh Berman from the Sierra Club.
First. This is great. I just wanted to make two points. I think it's great that you guys are revisiting this issue and getting a little bit more concrete. I just wanted to make two points that can walk where you guys can see me. So just want to remind folks, the original goal and the reason that this regulation had two phases was that based on the information that MDE presented to the council in the past, it was clear that on the days with the highest energy demand, which also often are the days with the worst air quality, it is the units in Maryland that do not have state-of-the-art emission controls for nitrogen oxides that are responsible at this point for the lion's share of the NOx emissions that are forming the ozone in Maryland. And so I just want to keep drawing the council's attention to this because ultimately what's really critical and what was so important about the way phase two was structured was that these emission units, this phase one regulation does very little, if anything, to actually ensure that emissions are being reduced from the most important units on the most important days that are really causing the air quality problem. So I want to keep the council's attention focused on that as we get to phase two. The other point I just wanted to raise, and maybe a little reminder of something I believe Mr. Schoen said at the October Air Quality Control Advisory Council meeting, the 2020 compliance date for phase two was the product of significant negotiation that was very closely tied to the substance of the regulation that ended up being agreed on and that the council approved. And if I recall correctly, Mr. Schoen pointed out, he said to us, if this regulation gets weakened any further, the original compliance deadline for phase two was 2016, got moved to 2018, got moved to 2020. I believe he said, if this gets weakened any further, please take it back to us because we would have concerns. I just want to flag that if the starting point of the discussions for the next stakeholder meeting for what's going to happen in phase two is that 2020 is the starting point and we're now going to be kind of working on ways to potentially, kind of water this regulation down further from that. I just wanted to just bring the council's attention back to the fact that this regulation is already a substantial compromise from what was originally proposed by MDE, particularly with regard to time frame. I hope I did not misstate what I believe you had said at that meeting. So just those are the two points I wanted to make. Thanks.
Okay, any questions for Josh from Sierra Club or the council? Okay, then Gene Trevisco, I'm sorry.
Trevisco. Yes, good morning. Thank you very much. I'm Gene Trevisco. I'm here on behalf of the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. We represent basically all the major coal producers, large electric utilities, mainly in the Midwest and the South, and all Class A railroads in the United States. And Maryland relies on our railroad members for all of its coal-based generation. We participated in the stakeholder process at MDE from the beginning of the NOx regulatory development. We were very disappointed when at the last minute of this process last year, the so-called flexibility provision in phase two was removed. Now that was done in a process that was outside the scope of the normal stakeholder meetings. A group of interested parties met with MDE and reached a so-called compromise on the design of phase two that eliminated this flexibility provision. The reason that that was of concern to us is that in the absence of that flexibility provision, phase two was a shutdown order for the affected coal generation units that are not now equipped with SCR. And that's due to the cost of installing SCR on an older and smaller plant. Going back to the beginning of the stakeholder process, I offered Tad, what was it, a 10-minute lecture on the economics of retrofitting SCRs on the power plants. What happened in Maryland under the Healthy Air Act is what happened really everywhere around the eastern United States under EPA's CARE, Clean Air Interstate Rule. That was the most advanced pollution controls were installed on the largest baseload plants, the plants that could incur those costs and continue to operate in a competitive market. Other plants used other types of controls, ranging from low NOx burners with overfired air, selective non-catalytic reduction, and so on and so forth. The NOx controls, FYI, are layered. They're incremental. You can have a plant that has several different NOx controls, not just one. But by requiring in the final version of the 2020 rule that a plant either retrofit SCR, switch to natural gas, or shut down, in effect, what that rule was doing was requiring shutdown of those units. And this was a disappointment to us because in the midst of the stakeholder process, before your meeting in October, we had understood from comments made by MDE that the SCR requirement in 2020 really was a bridge too far. It was too much to ask because there was an understanding of these underlying economics. Your utilities, and they're not utilities in Maryland, are independent generators operating in a competitive market. They're not regulated by the Maryland Public Service Commission. And that is why, if confronted with a multi-hundred million dollar capital investment requirement to retrofit SCRs, the answer will be the plants will be shut down. They will not be retrofitted with SCRs. So that's why we were very pleased in this meeting to hear that MDE will convene a stakeholder process to revisit the 2020 regulation with a greater sensitivity to the jobs issues that are implicit in it and also for the Maryland economy. And that, by the way, is consistent with the comments that we offered to MDE late last year in light of the final regulation. Thank you very much.
Questions for Mr. Trisco and the council? Okay.
Thank you.
Hearing none, I believe we are ready to move to the last item on our agenda.
I just could ask one question.
No.
If plants were like that were shut down, where would that power come from?
That's an excellent question. It's very similar to the aftermarket catalyst issue about where you're going to go to purchase the lower cost catalyst. The power likely would come from states with less rigorous NOx control requirements on their EGUs. So in effect, it could end up resulting in an increase in NOx emissions through leakage.
Ross?
I want to offer an alternate answer to that question. So I served on a committee, Governor O'Malley, so during his term, appointed a committee to make recommendations to the state about how it will meet its future electricity needs, and basically it's going to be natural gas. There are companies that have submitted applications for permits to build future plants, and that's almost certainly, if it's in the pipeline, it would be within the state of Maryland, probably within Prince George's County. There's supply lines in place, so it would be competitive but almost certainly it would be in state through natural gas.
Other questions from the council? Thank you, Ross. Other questions from the council?
One other observation. I completely agree with Mrs. Salovich about natural gas playing a larger role in the future, but I think one other thing to keep in mind is that Maryland's coal fleet, although some of the units did upgrade their emission controls to state-of-the-art controls under the Healthy Air Act, at this point, if you look at the adjacent states on the east, Maryland actually lags behind almost all of them, including states like Pennsylvania and West Virginia, substantially far behind states like West Virginia, in terms of the coverage of the coal plants that actually have selective catalytic reduction technology installed. Some of those states have not been operating those controls and on all of their plants, and that's something that, you know, CAT is working in a number of different contexts to address. But in terms of whether you're actually going to end up with dirtier power if Maryland's fleet is allowed to continue operating without selective catalytic reduction, I think it's very, very, I would definitely challenge the assumption that it's going to simply shift to plants that don't have these controls, because there are very few of those plants remaining in the east.
May I comment on that? That the flexibility provision is yet to be revisited and reconsidered. But that flexibility provision could implicitly entail environmental dispatch requirements such that the bulk of the generation in compliance with that provision would be coming from SCR-equipped plants. And the plants equipped with SNCR low NOx burners would run less in order to comply with it.
Other questions from the council?
And I guess the natural gas would come mostly from fracking, right? The source itself.
Yes.
Seeing Ross say, yeah.
Almost certainly.
Okay, other questions? Okay, now I think we're ready to move to the last briefing on our agenda, distributed generation reporting rule. And Heather's going to do this.
So I'll introduce it, though. The council has discussed this issue before. Over the past 5, maybe 10 years, one of the things that we've seen shifting in the energy world is that on the days when we need electricity the most, smaller units that in some cases were never designed to run routinely are being asked to generate energy. And this has been a quickly evolving area, and I think we approached the council several years ago with potential regulatory initiatives to actually go in and regulate, in many cases, diesel generators that were being asked to run, backup diesel generators that were being asked to run on a more routine basis on peak demand days. The market has changed. There are new provisions within the PJM energy market. And in all honesty, where we are is we do not have the data we need to really make decisions on whether this is an issue that we really need to get our hands around. And so this is a briefing that we believe will eventually lead to a data collection rule. We are not the only states struggling with this issue. This is a major initiative within the OGC states, and I think we all suffer from lack of really good data on who really is running equipment, smaller generators, sometimes poorly controlled smaller generators on peak demand days. We just do not have good enough data on that right now. So this is a fairly comprehensive briefing of a fairly controversial topic. It's bound to generate a lot of questions, but it's an important area. It's in my opinion, one of the more important issues that the states along the I-95 corridor need to deal with. It's a particularly important issue in the area around New York City because of the huge growth in the use of these smaller distributed generation sources. So, Randy?
Thank you. Tad had given us a good background. We're also going to cover a little bit of we have an existing regulation in place since I think it's from 2009. We've had a regulation in place in Maryland, and just how these generators are called out. There's a group called curtailment service providers that really make the notifications for these generators to come online when they're needed, when the high electric demand is in place. We'll just have a few slides on summaries of just how these engines are operating based on some of the data that we've collected through these curtailment service providers and through other, and do a little comparison as far as some of these other backup emergency generating units are being called into place. And some of the new rules that are in place, as I mentioned, PJM's demand response program rules, as well as EPA rules, which are really changing the game, is just who can participate, how often they can run. It's really becoming a much more difficult process for these engines to be called into place, as well as reporting rules that are being required through the federal government, which may help answer a lot of the questions that we're looking at and may ultimately provide us the answers we're looking for. And to cap it all off, just some of the considerations that the department's looking at based upon what our findings are, how these different rules play out in the future. So as we pointed out here, stationary generators, these are commonly just put in place large commercial buildings, schools, hospitals, gas stations, just about any facility you can think of that needs a backup generator for critical loss of power in case a power line goes down or something. You don't want to lose your inventory. If you're a grocery store, you want to keep your ice cream cold and your milk fresh and neat. They basically are designed to come online in the event of loss of power. But as Pat mentioned, more and more that we're finding that in the past they have been partnering up with curtailment service providers to actually provide relief to the grid during times of high energy demand days. Most of these engines are diesel fuel. They're old. They're like a truck engine, if you will. They can run for many years. And the older you go back, there were no pollution control requirements, so these older, bigger engines are much dirtier than the newer ones, and they release significantly more pollution per unit of power than a power plant. So just from a clean air perspective, we much rather see, you know, the power being distributed to the state from the power plants rather than these generators coming online, which can, you know, at times become an economic incentive more than the run. This is just a little bit of a comparison of how these generators have improved over the years. As you can see, this line here is within our regulation, it's NVE's load shaving rate. Those generators, emergency generators that are being used to come online during economic programs, we have in our regulation right now, you need to meet a 1.4 grams per brake horsepower hour rate. That's one of the compliance options. There's others I'll describe in our rule later. But as you can see, going back in time, earlier engines, 15 grams per brake horsepower hour. And as we move through the years, EPA, like year two, it went down to 6.4. And some of the newer engines, tier four and beyond, are below what NVE standards are and comparable with some of the rates that the OTC were looking at and had built into their model rule. So the engines are really, these diesel engines are cleaning up significantly. And it's important to note as well that there are they're few, but there are natural gas engines out there as well. And just as a kind of a sample for some of a comparison, say, these HEDD units, high energy demand day units, which are similar to just power plant. As you can see, some of them being called online, the diesel power one at Harriman CT3, 12.35 pounds per megawatt hour. It had run 135 hours in 2011. I don't know if we were seeing additional run times in 2012 through 14. Kathy, did you know?
I haven't checked.
We don't have the data on that, but this just gives an idea of how often maybe some of these bigger units are called into play on some of the hotter summers, like 2011, 2012, probably these units not so much in the later, the two poorer years we've had in 2013 and 14.
So when were those units produced? Were those produced in 2011? Or are they older units? Or are they?
They're older units.
The Perryman and stuff? And
Perryman is an older unit. These lower two are running on natural gas, so that's consequently why you see lower emission rates coming from them. So basically what we're seeing here, Kathy, maybe you'd like to explain this slide if you want.
Skip over it and I'll get back to it.
Do you want to jump back to this one later?
Sure.
It's just showing that some of these older rates, it can be as high as, for instance, a 396, as high as 15 pounds for MMBTU. They're quite dirty engines in some of the older. Some of the plans here are just ratcheting down on it. So this is the regulation we have in place. It was regulations we had scattered throughout COMAR. I believe it was in 2010. We consolidated the regulations into their own chapter. Basically, the premise of the regulation was to establish NOx emission requirements for emergency generators and load shaving units, those that were coming online for economic purposes. And for the economic engines, those load shaving units, we had a series of compliance options. Either the engine had to be newer in a sense or controlled so that it could meet a NOx emission standard of 1.4 grams per brake horsepower hour, or you could purchase ozone season NOx allowances to offset the amount of the time that you're running the unit, or basically just limit the unit's use to 10 hours or less throughout the summer period. So there were, during the time we put out the regulation, a number of facilities that were actually running their engines and utilizing them in that fashion. They were purchasing allowances for the most part or limiting their use. Very few of them in place in the state of Maryland were controlled and running frequently in that sense. We tacked onto the regulation in 2011 CSP, curtailment service provider reporting requirement, because the bulk of these engines that were being dispatched to run were being operated through a curtailment service provider. So in order for the state to have a better sense of those engines, how often they were operating, what was the size of them, can we get some grasp on the pollution problem that is being generated from this? We started to collect this information, and it's been very helpful. We've actually gotten a lot of information since that time. And basically, again, the curtailment service providers provide economic incentives for the owner of the engines to either run their engines during time of increased energy demand, or in many ways offer other curtailment activities. So a good amount of the electric reduction that comes from these facilities that participate with CSPs come from just turning off lights where they're not needed in certain areas, setting air conditioning up, or setting refrigeration levels, just making those type of alterations in the plant so that they're drawing less energy from the grid. But when the engines are caught in play, when they're running, it results in excess NOx emissions on peak ozone days. So typically when these engines are caught in the play are days that we're seeing much higher temperatures out there, so it's much more conducive to bad ozone formation. It's the exact opposite time of what we want, a dirty type of engine to be caught in play and running. So since 2011, they've been sending us annual reports and be summarizing the engine usage and other curtailment activities. So we have a good sense of what's going on. All of this is marked confidential. It's proprietary information to the company, but we are just able to summarize and get a better picture of what's going on in the market. And maybe, Kathy, you could add on to that a little bit about how we've seen a reduction in the number of actual call-outs that have taken place, too. I don't know if we have that table. Maybe we do. So what we're just trying to determine, are engines still being operated? While we are collecting all this great data from CSPs, there's still a good amount of what we believe is going on in the market, is that still engines are, or owners of engines are either being notified or they have a sense of when it's advantageous or economically advantageous to run their engine. So how do we get at that type of information? I know that the federal governments within the EPA's rules are starting to set in just requirements that are, and hey, if you have an engine and you're operating, you know, you're having to submit that type of data. That's some of the things that we've been starting to look at here in Maryland. Should we do something similar within our rules, just so we have a better sense? It's not entirely known. Since the inception of this program, Maryland has contracted out to get a grasp on who are using these engines, how often they're running. While we did worry or collect some data, we weren't ever fully confident that we had the full answer to this problem. So as I pointed out, the new EPA rules, they significantly limit the operation of the engines for economic programs and for non-emergency usage as well, and as well as having their own reporting requirements built into it. So we're going to be continuing to just keep track of these. They're undergoing some litigation now. They came out in 2013, I believe. So they're just about nearing completion, we're hoping. We know the state of Delaware had challenged some minor provisions of the regulation. That's sorting itself out as well, but that'll make a big difference for us once EPA's new rules are up and in play. And here is where I'm going to turn it over to Kathy. It's a confusing bingo chart here. She'll be able to point it out. You have the slides in your packet if you're having trouble reading them.
We have one question for you.
Just clarification. So what is the minimum size of the engines that you're talking about that apply to this?
Well, for our regulations right now, we're permitting through our permits. It's 500 horsepower or less are required to get a permit. So when they do that, they have the 500 horsepower or more.
Okay.
If they're emergency, but if they're not emergency, technically you're supposed to get a permit, whatever.
Yeah, dependent on size. If you're participating in economic, but I
nobody
comes
in and gets permit, so if anybody's doing it.
We're unaware of really small engines that are doing a load shaving.
And like a house backup system or something like that.
For the emergency part, it doesn't apply to residential.
Okay. Just kind of clarify.
So we're talking about engines that are 500 horsepower or larger?
Yes. Are permitted, and in that permit process, they check off whether they're for emergency backup or they're participating in economic load shaving programs.
Okay. So a 250 horsepower engine doesn't even come into play?
Unless they're load shaving, technically they should.
No, I think Kathy's data will explain a little bit more. No, the what MDE permits is different than what the curtailment service providers can sign up. So we were finding that engines as small as 100 horsepower could be in the program. You know, if you're the grocery store, you might run your engine to do the emergency lights, and then you turn down your refrigeration. And those are the events or the people that we're capturing in these reports.
And that is an important point to point out, that with this curtailment service provider rule, it really helped us out in getting a lot of permits. They really went out to their customers and ensured that they were aware of the state rules and submitting their permits. So it was that rule in itself was a big help for us.
Thank you, Kim.
Hi. Okay, so what I wanted to start off with is, after Randy finished up, there are three things that the Maryland Department of the Environment was looking into. Number one, we're trying to reduce the size of the engines down to 100 horsepower. We also, which is something that we always seem to forget, is we're trying to find engines that are not going through CSPs. Right now, we only really get records from engines that are under a contract with a CSP. And right now there may be an engine that's behind a hospital that isn't contracted up with the CSP, but they may still be operating. So that's another thing I wanted to focus on. And then the third thing I also wanted to focus on is, we are not setting emission limits with what we're talking about right now. We are not proposing to reduce the emission rates or the hours of operation or anything else like that. We're leaving that up to the feds. What we want to do right now is just collect this data. And the reason we want to collect this data is this guy over here, because he comes in and he's like, I need more data. I need to figure out why we can't reach our NACs. So as a result, we sat down and we're like, okay, what can we do in order to collect this data? And so what we need to do, and I'm sorry, I just found out at like 8:30 this morning that I'm presenting this, but we need to find these generators that we don't know about. Not only are there generators that exist that aren't permitted because they don't have to be, there are also generators that are 30 years old that are just operating that never actually submitted for a permit. So we need to make sure that these guys are actually reporting their operation. As a theory, engines can operate for a number of reasons. As Randy pointed out, when you're under a CSP program, you can actually be contacted by the CSP and told, turn on your engines, because right now the cost is $400 per megawatt hour. But 12 hours later, it may only be $10 per megawatt hour. So if you're operating your engine while the cost of electricity is $400 a megawatt hour, you may actually be saving money if you have a large facility and a large backup generator. But we don't know, because you, okay, look, it's actually kind of weird. You can make money by running your generator if it costs less than PJM is at that time paying for power. And does everybody know who PJM is, I hope, at this point? Say yes. Is there anybody who doesn't? Good. Okay, then I'm going. If you look at PJM's webpage, you'll see spikes where it'll go up to $500. And Carolyn, that is not in there.
It's the next slide.
I thought that slide got removed.
Well, it at least describes their demand response programs.
Yeah, that slide kind of got removed. I will get to this eventually. So what the CSP does, the CSP, if you sign up with the CSP, there are two circumstances where you can get contacted. One is if there's too much of a load on the system. They will call you and say there's too much of a load on the system, because under FERC regulations, they have to have like a 15% above what's projected capacity, so that if a system collapses, they have to have that energy available. And the other time they can call you is when the price is too much, because they're basically like advising you on stock market investments. This thing's going to go up this afternoon, buy it now, before, or whatever. So they're giving you financial advice. We don't know when this is always happening, because as an independent, like for instance, if you owned a generator or a warehouse, you could turn your generator on, because PJM updates the prices every 5 minutes. It's real time on the internet, where you can sit there and watch. So all of a sudden, it'll be up around $400, and you can say, it only cost me $50 to do that, so I can save $350 a megawatt hour, so I'm turning on my generator. All of these generators that we make that either are not permitted or not signed up with the CSP, or turning on just because they're watching PJM's webpage and they're seeing the price go on, as Tab pointed out, we don't know they're operating. We have no idea. But if you think about it, during these events when it's 400 megawatts, if you've got a lot of really smart people who know a lot about electricity or have taken courses, they may be turning on their generator. And Tad wants to know, who are they, where are they, how often are they doing it? And we're sitting there and going, I don't know, because we don't have the regulations, nor does the federal government have the regulations to collect this kind of data. So we had to develop something that was regulatory that would make it available for us to collect this kind of data. So our proposed regulation was, anybody who was 100 horsepower or greater, we didn't care how they were permitted or what they were doing or when they were operating or anything else, we wanted their hour meter reading at the beginning of the year and at the end of the year. That was the minimum. We would also like when they run, but we were respective of the fact that some people may have automatic switch on. Then we also wanted non-CSP, and that was it. Then, I want to talk about load shaving before I go any further. Load shaving is a word that keeps on going through gyrations and changes of its meaning. load shaving, I would say 4 or 5 years ago when we first started talking about this, load shaving meant turning on your generator and not drawing off the grid. So you were drawing off the grid, but you were running your generator at the same time. Load shaving is not a word that I'm seeing used much in publications anymore. We're seeing more of a demand program or something like that. Load shaving is being discouraged in its use both by PJM and EPA because it suggests that you're shaving your load and running your generator. Somehow that came up. What they're trying to use now is curtailment. Curtailment is a really good word because what's happening is people are curtailing their draw on the grid, and therefore we've got that buffer zone that NERC wants in order to continue moving forward. They will call you, again, going back to you, they'll call you and say, hey, the CSP will, and they'll say, we need you to reduce your draw on the grid by 20%. And they're calling 200 other people. So by doing that, they can get the buffer zone that NERC wants them to get. So that's what we're trying to achieve. So load shaving was done more as a cost basis, where they were telling you it's 400 and you can run for 50. And for some reason, that's how load shaving came about to be interpreted. Load shaving was done or often involved 5 minutes? Oh dear. Okay. Load shaving often involved backup generators or behind the meter generators, which are diesel generators, generally reciprocating generators, that did not have controls. They were just, you ran because you were called by the CSP. Okay, and then we had some issues that came up. As in the last few months, first of all, we had what Randy referred to is the regulation that came out by the EPA for 40 CFR 60 and 40 CFR 63. They're going through, they are likewise, they've made load shaving illegal as of May 2014. It's now illegal to load shave. So that's a good thing. The next thing that, another one of our concerns is that there have been changes in PJM. Around June of last year, PJM rewrote their whole emergency demand response program and got rid of the word load shaving. Load shaving is no longer allowed. Back to the feds. The feds have different emergency. They're also like, but since I only have like 4 more minutes, I'm going to tell you that we're going to just go through some of these sides. The emergency, the definition of emergency has also changed. CSPs used to be able to call you up for financial reasons or for NERC concerns where there was grid stability. So there were the financial and the grid. Because of the new federal regulations, financial incentives are no longer allowed. EPA strictly said that load shaving is not allowed, but you can do it if there is an EEA level 2. And if you people know what EEA level 2 is, awesome. It's something that was written by NERC, which says we have grid ickiness. It doesn't say that, obviously, but it just indicates that the overall grid is becoming not where they would like it. It's showing signs of falling apart because there's too much of a demand in one area. It's too hot in one area or something like that. That's an EEA level 2. Energy level 2 might be on there somewhere, EEA level 2, which is why I'm saying this. The next reason that a CSP can call and tell you...
Let me make a suggestion, because the time is limited. What the council is going to, I think, want to hear a lot about is potential paths forward and anything that may come before them. So there's a lot...
Okay,
of,
I know, I know.
There's a lot up here, and I don't think we're going to be able to digest all of it.
Okay, and the other... But I just want to finish, because then I'm going into my slides. And the other one is if there's a 5% variation in the grid. So when you get to this, this is the thing that TAB really hasn't seen too much, and this is the part that I'm looking at. During 2011, What I wanted to point out, because one of the concerns is people are, there's still load shedding going on. During 2011, there were two EEA level 2 events. Those are the ones that are rounded out in red. One was on 531, 2011, and the other one was on 722, 2011. If you look at, this is from the data that we collected from the CSPs. Again, I know the letters are small, but 531 and 722, you can look at, it says combination curtailment and generator. So a combination is where people curtail and they also turn on their backup generator. Generators when they generate in combination, you got it. So on 531, our ozone reading was 85, 200, basically 235 hours of generators was operated during a 2-hour period. Because that's what the CSPs called upon. That's what our records indicate. And they emitted based on worst case scenario, if they didn't provide us the age or the size or anything, we estimated their emission rate. It was 1.3 tons during that event. On 722-2011, again, ozone reasons, 322, based on X, Y, and Z, it would have been 6.9 tons were emitted during that event from the generators that are listed through a CSP program. The other ones, we don't know who or what they are. What?
For a perspective for everyone's information, excuse me, is that the slides that Tad has been showing for the electric generating units, the coal power plants can emit anywhere between 36 to 53 tons per day. So that's the significance or where these numbers fall in against the power generation.
We'll be coming back to this, so we might need to move to the wrap-up because I know we're over time.
Okay, and I'm just telling you again, PJM has changed a lot. Again, it's something that is a little bit too above and beyond, but they've gone into pre-emergency. PJM used to encourage turning on backup generators. They even, in June of 2014, changed their regulation and said, you can't run your backup generator because of environmental constraints. And I have the references in here. Actually, it says here, any environmentally restricted units. So PJM is also on board. Everybody's on board. Tad brought up that the OTC is moving towards this program and moving, you know, everybody's working on it. So I just wanted to, I'll finish right now because everybody wants me. It's a big deal. And there's lots of activity, there's lots of interest from the EPA, from PJM, from NERC, from OTC, from the MDE. So just be aware that this is not going to be a simple thing as we move forward, mainly because a lot of us don't know a lot about PJM. PJM is very difficult to communicate with, and that's where we're headed. If you have questions, wait till the next visit.
I can wrap up the last slide. Great.
Oh, yeah. There's the last slide.
So with this being laid out, obviously, we're showing a picture that there's still a lot of information that's out there. And with a lot of the federal rules and the PJM changing coming online, there may be less of a need to really collect this information as EPA's having rules in place that are having some reporting requirements being set into place. Once that rule is final, we'll have a better sense as to whether that's sufficient as far as the data that we're looking and hoping to collect and whether we have access to that data. So we're going to be coordinating with EPA to see if we can obtain those records and if that's going to answer a lot of the questions that we're posing right now. So in addition to that, we're also considering maybe public awareness campaigns so we can really reach out to those people who are not set up through CSP systems right now that hey, we've got regs on the books. We're looking to, you need to make sure that you have a permit in place and you're following the requirements, as well as we just wanted them to be aware of the federal and the state requirements. So what may come of this is we may be updating our reporting and record-keeping requirements for engines in COMARC 26-1136. We do have the CSP reporting rule, but we may be looking to set it out for those people not participating in the Surveillance Service Provider Program. And we may also be looking at just overhauling our regulations as well, just because our current regulations are out of date. There's been a lot that's been changing in the federal reporting rules, as well as OTC model rules that are out there that are much more up to speed with the current practices and the emission rates. So there's may address those in many, many years later, but right now it's the reporting and just finding out the practice that we're concerned with. So that was a very complex subject and a very quick run.
Sorry if they got too complex too quick, but what is true is I am putting a lot of pressure on my staff to figure this out, because I am very frustrated because I found it so difficult to get a simple answer. Are there a lot of emissions that we ought to be worried about? And unfortunately, the answer isn't simple. And so the good news is that that EPA has moved forward with some regulations that we think are going to help. And the folks, the PJM folks that figure out how to call on energy are also changing some of the ways they do their business. And, you know, the diesel generators are becoming a smaller piece, at least according to PJM. So we will be back to you with this, but it's one of those areas where when we talked about power plants and peak day emissions, we said that we're getting to a point where we're very focused on what really happens on the peak days, and this is just another example of really drilling down what really happens on the bad ozone days, which unfortunately line up with the days we need the most electricity. So anyway, sorry it got too complex. But,
and if anybody has information they want to share with Kathy or myself, we'd be willing to exchange emails.
Just anecdotally, I mean, over the years of my career in property operations and building engineering design, I've been involved with installation of emergency generators, and it hasn't been very recently, but I know years ago there wasn't much reporting for smaller generators. Wasn't any reporting that I'm aware of to NDE. They're out there, and some of them are still operating, I'm sure.
Yes, question. Just a comment. So, as said at the beginning when I introduced myself, that we study air pollution, and we published a paper a few years ago with the lead author was Hal Herr, Russ Dickerson was involved. We certainly see that the nitrogen oxides in our atmosphere go up considerably during summer as a function of temperature. The only reasonable explanation of that is these peaking units. Be happy to send you a copy of the paper. So we call that kind of the top-down approach, just looking at the whole system. We see this. I mean, people don't drive their cars anymore on a hot summer day than on a cooler summer day and go to work on both. So that could provide some insight as well.
Great.
Other questions from the council? Anything you'd like to know about this in the future that you'd like the department to give us more information about? Okay. Any closing comments?
Just our next formally scheduled meeting is September 21st. We have started to talk to John Quinn about if we need an earlier ACAC meeting because of the Phase 2 2020 NOx regs, we might have to work on that. But right now, we're just sticking with the 21st. And I'd like to thank Larry for being our chair of the day and fill it in. It moved us through the agenda, so I appreciate it. So.
Okay, anything else from council? Any objections to adjourning? By acclamation, so adjourned. Thank you.